From Social Service to SG, I am Jing Yao. Introducing this episode hosted by Isaac. GST hikes, inflation, and high HDB resale prices. Wherever you go in Singapore, you can't miss the hottest topic nowadays, the rising cost of living. If you tak boleh tahan, that's understandable. But what can Singaporeans do about it? Today, we're joined by three organizers, Fukila from Workers Made Possible and the Transformative Justice Collective, Kuma from Workers Made Possible, and Adi from Workers Made Possible and NTU Financial Aid Friends to talk about how Singaporeans can make their voices heard on these issues. The trio are part of Many Festival, a joint effort by various civil society organizations and independent media platforms to encourage democratic public discussion on important issues that matter to all of us in Singapore. We asked them about how Many Festival came about, the three town hall series that Many Festival has organized in the past months, and their takeaways from having ordinary Singaporeans share their honest thoughts in such public spaces.
Okay, so hi, Koki, Adi, and Kuma. Thanks for coming on to the podcast. So maybe I could get you guys to just do a quick self-introduction of yourself and which organization you're from. Maybe we'll start with Koki.
Okay, hi, Isaac. I'm Koki. I'm work with the Transformative Justice Collective, Workers Make Possible, and I'm also part of the organizing team for Manifestable.
Yeah, hi. My name is Kumar. I'm from Workers Make Possible, local workers' rights group, and I'm also a part of the organizing team for Manifestable.
Yeah, hi. I'm Adi. I'm part of a few organizations, but mostly I'm from Workers Made Possible, and I'm also from a new up-and-coming organization called NTU Financial Aid Friends.
Cool. So maybe we'll just get started. And so if you guys could, you know, share a little bit of how Many Festival came about.
Yeah, I think about 2 years ago, a few civil society groups got together and we started talking about what it meant to build solidarity amongst civil society groups in Singapore and sustain our learning of each other's issues and the work that we've all been doing, and also identify common areas, shared struggles, and also shared aspirations among the groups. And so Manifestival was one of the ideas that came up from those discussions. We started out as a group that, you know, would just take turns casually to share what each of us has been up to, hear what others would be willing to do in solidarity, to like maybe like share joint statements, learn from each other's research reports and things like that. And then we decided that we wanted to do more together. And so Manifestival started out first as an kind of intimate space for civil society groups to explore issues that cut across all of our areas of work. So at first they were quite closed door and intimate. So they were just kind of potluck gatherings where we would come together, pick a topic that was current and on all of our minds, have maybe a speaker or someone to kick it off, and then we would just have open discussions and eat together and spend time together, you know, because it's quite precious and also rare for civil society to have intimate spaces together. So that was really the original intent. And then I think our ambitions grew and the town halls came later.
Mm-hmm. Okay, cool. I guess for Adi, Kuma, were you guys there from the start or did you like hop on board after?
Yeah, pretty much there from the start for myself. And I guess, I think for me personally, it always struck me how, like, you know, whenever we try to get solidarity signatures, mm-hmm. right, from different organizations, there's always a isolated conversation, right, between like organization A to organization B. And the reasons for that aren't discussed in relation to the other organizations. So actually what mm-hmm. spurred me to think about solidarity across organizations and building sort of like trying to actually organize things together was that question, like, how are we going to get signatures for one of the, at that time I was in SG Climate Rally, right? And we were trying to get signatures for the food delivery riders issues. right? We did a petition against the petrol hike, and we thought that, and actually because it was COVID also, we could just organize Zoom sessions. So that kind of also made it easier to like get everybody in the same room at the same time. And from there, we realized like, it was quite interesting to have conversations between two different migrant labor groups, for example, different like social service groups, for example. There are different reasons for like signing and not signing. Right. A lot of times fear is the first thing that's the forefront of our minds. Can we get IPC? Can we do this? Can we do that? But when these things are discussed in relation to one another, we realize that, hey, actually, maybe some things are not so big and some things are a lot smaller than the others. And the discussion really, it's a whole different layer. Yeah.
I think also one of the things that spurred this work was the realization that, you know, we actually have a lot of common ground, but we don't often spend a lot of time building that common ground, right? And often when something happens that we need to react to, that a particular group decides to take on, then it can be quite an effort to reach out to different groups one by one and see if they're willing to come on board. And that actually, if we had a network where there was shared understanding and commitments along shared principles, that it would be easier to do joint actions.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. Yeah, so I guess just delving into, you know, the recent events that Manifestable has been hosting, the Tak Boleh Tahan Town Halls. So for our listeners, so Tak Boleh Tahan, translated from Malay roughly as cannot take it anymore, is a joint effort by civil society organizations and independent media platforms to encourage democratic and public discussion on important issues in Singapore. And the title draws inspiration from the Tak Boleh Tahan campaign in 2008. This was by the Singapore Democratic Party that protested against the raising of the GST from 5 to 7%. So the Tak Boleh Tahan town halls recently held in January, February, and April focused on the GST hike, rising cost of living, CPF and welfare policies, and housing affordability. So I guess just to first off ask you guys, how did the idea of the town halls come about and how did you all settle on the topics?
I think there was, like I was saying earlier, the discussion started off as quite intimate between civil society members. And then we felt that there was actually a lot of interest in some of these kind of bread and butter issues, right, is what we would call them. And the national budget was coming up. There was the GST hike was announced. And there was a lot of public reactions to these announcements. And, you know, this was really something that felt urgent, that we needed to have a public space, a people space to debate these issues and develop our own understandings and have dialogue, open dialogue with fellow people, right, on issues that affect all of us. So I think that the imagination of it was that, you know, these are issues that so deeply affect all of our day-to-day lives, and they're being debated in parliament amongst a very small group of people, often a very elite group of people. And so I think the desire was to have in parallel the same discussions in a more democratic fashion, right, where people from all walks of life could participate, could share their opinions, and that it could be a vibrant forum for the people to experience what it is to participate in democratic discussion, right? Because that's something that we have so little space for in Singapore. So I think it came from a desire to also unpack the many complicated issues around the national budget and make it accessible and connect it to the lived experiences of the working class. Yeah, so I would say that those were some of the impetuses.
Yeah, I think that generally people do have like so-called like, you know, normal people or people on the ground, even though they have very little power in the sort of like democracy that we have, they actually have a lot of like really good solutions and really good policy suggestions that I think, as much as like good policy comes from, you know, good data, good evidence, as well as a good like foundational background in like policy making, theoretical policy making, I think a big part of what's like missing from the way that our policies are made is lived experience, right? And I think like what has like popped out to me the most from Tak Boleh Tahan, and I think it's also kind of the reason, like what Koki said, right, is that really, really good solutions to the crises that we have already exist. And all we have to do is to talk more about it and to rally behind these these solutions in a more democratic way. And sometimes that more democratic way would be actually outside of parliament, right?
Yeah, I think if I can add, I think the answer to the question is quite felt, right? And like what Adi said about lived experience, I think people feel and live the squeeze, right? We felt the squeeze for too long already, right? When you announced the GST hike, I think it was so many different sections of people from various communities, even various sort of like socioeconomic classes, all felt that like, why is this happening right after the pandemic? You know, people could see through how unreasonable this was and how impractical this was. And at the same time, very intuitively, and you see many surveys, actually even from the mainstream media, that shows that actually a majority are in favor of wealth taxes, right? But it's not even thought of as possible in this country. And I think where we're coming from is this place of common grievance and frustration. And like, why don't we talk about this? Right? Why aren't we talking about this? And for civil society organizations, why aren't we talking about this more? Right? Why aren't we putting this center stage? And actually, a lot of these issues affect so many different civil society groups, right? And I think when we talk about coming together, a lot of these issues actually bring us together, right? When we think of women's rights, when we think of migrant rights, we tend to think of them as separate issues, right? We also need to think about what actually binds us together. And a lot of it is the shared, felt, lived experience when it comes to material realities. And they are getting tougher, and they are getting, and we will feel the squeeze even more if we do not defend our own rice bowls and we do not protect our safety nets.
And I think the other thing I would add is that the town halls were, you know, in some ways, a manifestation of a theory, right? That where we felt that because we organized with communities on the ground, we know that and could feel the very real grievances that people felt day to day, the struggles that they're facing with getting access to welfare, the struggles that we face with getting housing, you know, whether as queer people, as single parents, like the people in our communities that we organize with and ourselves as organizers, right? And so we know that we're discussing these things over coffee table, over dinner with each other. And we know that there is this kind of rising groundswell of confusion, of grievance, of feeling stuck and trapped, and there not being a space to express it. And also to speak truth to power in the sense of communicating to people in power that these are actually widely felt and shared grievances. And so I think that the town halls were a test in that way to see really how is this theory true? Like what we are feeling in our communities and the people that we're in direct contact with, is it felt by a wider group of people? And I think the town halls showed that it indeed was, right? And like what Kumar was saying, these are issues that affect all of us as people living here, whether we're migrant workers, whether we're people facing incarceration, you know, which is like, so the different, and whether we're students, like the kind of group that Adi is from. So we all face these challenges and they're all related to the struggles that the different groups work on, right? Because so many people who face day-to-day struggles as working class people are the ones who end up in prison, right? Or entangled with the legal system. And so if people had better access to housing, to welfare, to healthcare, to good jobs, to decent wages, then they wouldn't get so entangled with the legal system and experience so many harsh kinds of punishment. So I think all of those things for us were clearly connected, and we wanted, I think, felt a deep desire to articulate those connections in a way that was immediately resonant to a critical mass of people.
Mm-hmm. Great. Yeah. No, I think I definitely get that for myself personally. I went to the second and third sessions, and I think I was really quite shocked by, you know, how open people were, especially, you know, during the parts where the audience could participate at sharing their, you know, frustrations with the system, but also like how forthright they were. So I have my own thoughts about that, but I just wanted to, you know, ask you all first, you know, after the three town halls, what are some takeaways from the town halls? Have they met, you know, your expectations in terms of the impact that you thought they would have?
Personally speaking, yeah, I do think so. And I think in a way, like, it kind of surpassed my expectations, because honestly, I maybe this is not necessarily just for myself, but like, I think a lot of Singaporeans are quite skeptical about our capacity or ability to speak openly and to be critical and to be analytical, right? In a way that that might blow back on us, right? But I think being in that environment, it's really like, it's really different watching the live stream versus being like there in person, which I think also is a point about like the importance of being in person for a lot of things. Is that, yeah, like it just makes you feel like, you know, you're not alone in struggling. And also that you know, it's that when we have this like mass, there's this large number of people who come together, right? That, you know, we don't feel that risk anymore. We don't feel that sense of fear, because it becomes very obvious that we are all in it together, right? Like, maybe not to be like too cliche about it, but yeah. And also, like, I think, like, from the perspective of a student, because I do think, like, the way that our universities and our, like, education system has, like, given us, like, a pretty good, like, foundational basis to be, like, quite analytical and honestly quite critical also. It's just that we have never really been given the opportunity to like, actually apply ourselves and to see our struggles in a larger light, because we think of ourselves as separate from the rest of society, right? But then I start to realize that a lot of the people, like especially the younger people who spoke during the event, you can really see like kind of like the best parts of the Singaporean education system coming into play and like allowing for people to provide this kind of level of analysis, but at the same time also like articulate like the real struggles that they're facing as like young people. So like personally speaking, like as part of the anti-financial aid friends, we are trying to talk more about like the financial aid process in our school, right? And a big part of it is understanding that the cost of living crisis now is inherently tied to the reason why we are like so urgently want NTU to improve up the financial aid process. And like it becomes very clear when I see like a lot of the students who are talking during like the town hall segment, that connection becomes like very immediate, right? And that connection to a lot of other issues also becomes very immediate.
Yeah, so I definitely agree with Adi that it has surpassed our expectations in many ways. I think for me, often a lot of these platforms and spaces are precious also as practice ground for people to start inhabiting what it means to be a citizen. And I don't mean citizen in a nationality way, right? To be a member of a group, to be a member of a society. I think we are all innately political beasts, and it is not, you know, there's often like these tropes that Singaporeans are politically apathetic, but it is just that we live in a very censorious and authoritarian environment with so much of a culture of fear that I think just cannot be overstated. But it is, I think there's always, when we do create space for democratic discussion, there's always evidence that people thrive in that kind of environment, that they come alive, right? And I think it was so magical and beautiful to see people come alive politically in that way. And there's so much wisdom and richness in the room, right? Of wealth of understanding. And like people are so incredibly analytical because they are living this every day. And I think that was another thing that was really intentional about the town halls, is that you know, the speakers were not like policy experts, right? So they were regular, ordinary people. But they offered such profound analysis of the systems and power structures within which we live. And I think for me, even things like some of the speakers struggling to find their voice, right? Or stammering or hesitating, feeling intimidated and overwhelmed by that space is all part of the experience, because it is about practicing being political creatures and practicing being with each other and using our voices, right? And I think for me, like a lot of the rewarding aspects of it is also in that, you know, some of them have gone on to now be like speakers for our Labor Day rally, where there'll be like many more people, right? Like hundreds of people. And so I think it is that evolution of a growing community of people who are willing to use their voice to speak up and to dearly want to listen to each other, and who will encourage each other as we fumble through the process of discovering what our shared struggles and shared aspirations are.
If I can add to that, I think what for me the biggest takeaway was that it doesn't take an activist, like an activist in the typical way we understand, to bring up this side, to speak so bravely about these issues. It just takes people, right? And actually what we tried to frame our events, and I think we succeeded, is that it's a people's event, right? These are ordinary people who are living through these things and are able to offer such rich analysis and insights, and at the same time also give us a vision forward right? And how we can all be a part of that vision. So other than that, I think for me, I thought having Prof. Tay Keng Soon come and say that the younger people are useless was one of my highlights of the event, right? It provoked so much thought and I think a very good reaction that it also reminded me how, like, I'm very used to panels where everybody agrees with one another. We don't often give space for such disagreement and chaos and unpredictability. But you can see how, like, we dealt with it quite well. There was no disorder whatsoever, and people just took it well. And actually, there was a very good debate after that. I also want to say that in terms of the people who are coming to this event, right? I think each event we managed to get more than 100 people at each event. We sold out each, the venue spaces were all completely packed. So I think that's also, it shows that there is an appetite for this type of discussion. There is deep interest in cost of living issues, and this definitely impacts us.
Yeah, and you know, one of the things that we were quite intentional about doing also is that at each town hall, there were follow-up actions that people could take after, right? Yeah. So, you know, lots of people have continued to come to town hall. So it's been really nice to see familiar faces of people we've never seen at civil society events before, but who felt like they're not part of this community. People have signed up to be part of our different organizations. People have signed up to come to Labor Day, and in this, people even just came up to us spontaneously and said, can we help cover costs for something? So it is that spirit of people coming together that I think is really quite significant. So I think one other thought I wanted to add to what Kumar was saying earlier about how, you know, you don't need to be an activist. And these are issues that belong to all of us and struggles that belong to all of us as people who share this land, this society, you know, these communities. I think for me, it's also really important to signal a shift in what civil society means, right? And what we who identify as members of civil society, whether we call ourselves activists or organizers, or advocates, what our role is, right? That our groups don't become interest groups, right? As people who have the same, you know, identity as I'm a feminist or I'm an abolitionist, and then you join this group and then we just talk about these issues and we put out some things now and then on this topic, but that we become organizers, right? People who mobilize communities and connect, and that it is our role to create and push back on the continued forms of repression by the state, to shrink and disappear civil society spaces, but to push back and then to hold the line, right? Hold the fort so that more people can come into the space and own it. So I think the town halls to me are a metaphor for that.
I really like that, Koki. So I'll come back to that later. I wanted to touch on something, Kumar, you said, how there were speakers that didn't just agree with each other, they actually debated amongst each other. I think you mentioned Tay Keng Soon, really enjoyed that one as well. Felt a bit insulted, but I enjoyed it nonetheless. But so there was one of the town halls I went, it was the second one, where former NMP, Dr. Walter Tessera, he was there. So, the town hall was mentioning, I think it was about CPF, welfare policies, and, there were calls for increased wealth taxes, independent unions, more welfare spending, people are raising those during the audience session. And then he raised sort of like a provocation, all these policies that you want, all these changes, they need a buy-in by the middle and upper middle class, because these are the people who might not have the same lived experiences, as you say, for other people in Singapore, but then they'll see their tax bill rise as a result because of these policies when you propose them. So he said, there needs to be bridges built between low-income workers and more of the middle to upper middle-income workers. So do you agree with his assessment? And I don't know, how does it play into, what you said about being organizers, helping to bring people together and so on as the role of an activist?
Yeah, I actually largely agree with his assessment, because and I think because this notion of tax the rich comes from, it's very popular in the West, right? And I think because in Singapore we have a very big so-called middle income group, right? And this group may feel offended because they aspire to be wealthy, right? But very often what we mean by wealth, when we talk about taxing the rich, we mean the ultra rich. Right, in Singapore, we have 60 billionaires,
just over 60 billionaires, and we have that. It's not even 1%. It's like 0.0-something% of people who, I think, we're talking about obscene wealth, right? And I mean, to me, this is maybe a personal thing, but I don't think billionaires should exist, right? I don't think that as long as there's poverty in a country, there shouldn't be billionaires, right? Everybody should be taken care of, at least their basic needs, right? And so what we are really asking for here is to tax the ultra wealthy, right? And to make sure that there is this redistribution of income. I believe like there are even like articles that SGCR has written and many others have talked about that actually how wealth is created is also through underpaying a lot of lower income workers, right? So if you look at that relationship, rather than, oh yeah, these billionaires made their money in a certain way and like these people didn't work hard enough and maybe didn't study hard enough and so on, there's a relationship, right? A lot of these lower income workers are hired at the end by a main contractor or an ultimate shareholder who is a billionaire. And how they make money is actually by underpaying and by putting workers through really, really bad working conditions, right? Through pinching and being quite cheapskate on those things, right? That is what we think is unfair. And I think the way to build bridges here is to emphasize that it is the ultra wealthy and not the, for example, if you're a millionaire in Singapore, which to be honest, doesn't mean much, right? You get to buy a house. Okay, good for you. But right, because housing prices are so high and so on, but that's not really who we're talking about, right? Actually, the middle income workers, right? A lot of your very, very professional workers, right? Even private doctors and so on. We have a lot more in common than we do have in difference, right? You compare that to like the difference that you would have with a billionaire. I think, do people even know how much a billion is, right? Compared to, you know, earning even $10,000 a month or $9,000 a month. The difference is really minuscule. Yeah.
Yeah. And I would also add to that the kinds of things we're talking about is not just it's not just about what we have in common in terms of money, right? Because yes, it is a very, very different existence to be earning $20,000 a month versus $3,000 a month or $2,000 a month. And yes, your life is incredibly different, but there are things that are still very poignantly shared, I think, by the vast majority of the working class in Singapore. Whether you're a lawyer or whether you're a security guard, you barely get any sleep, right? You work all the time. And you don't have time for leisure, for community, to take part in the things that you care deeply about, to, you know, just not live in a constant pressure cooker. And that's something that is, I think, something most people can relate to. And it's something that we, you know, Kumar said at the very first town hall, like, how do you know? And he was quoting a Wake Up Singapore post, right? How do you know you're a Singaporean is if you leave while it's still dark and you go back home when it's dark. Right? And that's true for students, right? Often it's true for, again, like whether they're performing better academically according to our standards or not, there are different kinds of stressors, right? You're alienated, don't have resources to participate fully in the education system if you're from lower income communities and families. But also if you are from a family that has a lot more resources, you're constantly in tuition class for another tuition class. And there's so much anxiety, there's, you know, such high rates of suicide. So, you know, I think there are existential pressures across the working class, despite income levels, that I think people can connect and resonate on.
Yeah, just to quickly add to that, we're one of the countries with the least amount of sleep, right? That's, you can see the data on that. We're also one of the countries with the longest working hours, right? And I think something that we at Workers Make Possible, we're pushing for at this year's Labor Day, is to actually extend the entitlement to overtime to more workers, right? So currently, if you look at the Employment Act, and I believe like social workers who might be listening to this podcast might want to pay attention, you're not entitled to overtime if you earn less than if you earn more than, how much is it?
4.5.
If you earn more than, no, sorry, less than that, right? So, sorry,
2.6K?
Yeah. If you earn more than 2.6K, correct. So what we are asking for from Workers Make Possible's Labor Day is that anybody who earns 4.5K and below should be entitled to overtime, right? And actually, like I've asked this question to various people in power, like why does this exist? I mean, I myself used to work in the tech sector. I mean, currently, technically, I'm not entitled to overtime either as an employee. And the reason why is because we had a bit more education, we had a degree and so on, we have higher bargaining power. If we don't like the job, we can just leave and find a and the marketing will adjust itself. I would just ask listeners, is this true, right? You really feel that you could just leave the job and you can just walk into a contract that's much better? Maybe it's true for a tech worker, right, in this day and age, but I don't think that is true for nurses. I don't think that is true for even junior doctors. I don't think that is even true for social workers and many other so-called white-collar jobs that are working really, really long hours.
Yeah. And, you know, a lot of people who are in higher income groups in Singapore, too, don't feel able to retire, right? And I think that that is, again, a very strong shared anxiety. So I think there's lots of things like that. And another Labor Day demand that we have this year is for workplace fairness legislation, right? That will be really beneficial to middle income and higher income workers too, is so that they're not discriminated on the basis of gender and sexuality or disability or any other factor at work. So I think it is also important to articulate that when we talk about the improving the conditions of the working class, it is not just for the lowest income workers.
I think beyond like the issues that Koki and Kuma have raised, I think one that we feel a lot of tension in, especially now, is the housing crisis. And I think I think it's become very clear, even especially through the town halls, that there's almost this sense of, oh, you know, there's almost an irreconcilable like tension between the middle class and the lower income. And there doesn't seem to be like a quick fix, like the way that we have, for example, like we introduce wealth taxation, right? Where we know that there's a separation between the working class and these ridiculously rich billionaires, right? But the thing is that even with things like that, whereby, you know, a fix for example, the lower income would be detrimental to the middle income, this separation is actually manufactured as well, because it's built on a lie, right? Like the lie that like of financialization of housing as an asset, right? It can only go up to a certain point. Like if the middle class keeps believing this lie and doesn't rally around, you know, a shared understanding of how the housing market cannot continue to be like this, cannot continue to be financialized, right? And public housing cannot continue to be like this, then one day that bubble is also going to burst. And that became very, very clear, like through the town halls, like in my opinion, because I could actually see that, you know, there were a lot of like middle income families participants who are middle income, who fundamentally understood that this lie that their housing price will continue to appreciate and that they will continue to be able to cash in once they were once they saw like the how like this system has already collapsed for people in the lower income groups, then it becomes very clear that this will also happen to everybody in Singapore if this continues and if we don't restructure the way that our housing policy works. So yeah, like no matter what issue it is, right, it is always in the interests of the working class, no matter which part of the working class you are in, to rally together as the working class and not to, I guess, believe in these separations that I feel are used to pit us against each other, instead of understanding the real issues at hand, which is that a lot of our policies are based on, again, the interests not of the working class, not of the middle class or the lower income or upper middle income, but for those people, for the ruling elite, and also for these ultra rich billionaires. Yeah.
Yeah. I would just add to that, you know, I don't think that shared interest is only in terms of the wins we want, but the methods, because how will we win if we don't have each other, right? So whether it is a middle class concern or working class concern, a small group of people, like let's take LGBT workers, right? And discrimination of queer people in the workforce. Now, queer people can campaign for 10 years, 20 years, 30 years for them to not be discriminated against and have to rely on the goodwill of the state to then accede to those demands. Or we can mobilize across the working class, have a broad set of demands that cater to all of us and stand together behind this set of demands, including for the inclusion of queer people in the workforce and to not discriminate against them. Do you know what I mean? So I think it is about what it will take to win, that we do need each other, even if we don't have all the exact same concerns and all the exact same changes that we want. We cannot win without each other, right? Because they will continue to pit us against each other and throw little bits of morsels here and there to distract us from the fact that overall, our lives are not improving. And they're getting harder, they're getting more stressful, and people are generally more miserable.
Great. No, thanks for that, guys. I think you've really, like, you know, hit the nail on the head on, you know, whether you're low income, middle income, or upper middle income, you know, the commonalities that we all share as part of the working class. And also, you know, how certain issues and...
Yeah, I just wanted to share another commonality that we have.
Okay.
Actually, all of us are taxed by the government, right? All of us. If you just think about all the wealth taxes, that so-called wealth taxes that we have right now, right? Taxes on luxury cars, taxes on buyer stamp duty. And then you look at the taxes that have gone, right? Estate duties tax, that is gone. 2008, I believe. I'm not sure, did we have a capital gains tax before? Have we ever had that? Okay, probably not. So that one never even touched before, right? Rent control, also gone, right? So all these things that are meant to protect the upper middle and the rest of us, slowly going away. Instead, you have protection for the really, really ultra rich. And instead, what we have for us are spears, right? Weapons that are coming at our own rice bowls, right? And really coming at our own, like, safety nets and so on. So for me, that's another commonality. And I think what we need to think about is, what do we have that's shared, right? And how can these different sort of substratas, right? Upper middle, right? I think we're stratas, right? But we are one working class, really, right? And what we can do is be in solidarity with one another. I'll give you an example of something that I think upper middle and middle income workers can be in solidarity with the low income workers with, right? For example, social welfare, right? You look at one big thing that a lot of low income workers have is they try to access this thing called ComCare, right? And I think your podcast really covers this a lot. And, you know, being a social services podcast, ComCare is sometimes one of the low income residents' like worst nightmare to even go to. We have to rely on having to step into that office feels like hell sometimes, right? It's like playing a lottery, right? The hope that you get a good SSO officer. If not, then you're going to be, your mind is going to be racing and you're going to be questioning yourself, am I a good mother? Am I a bad father? That kind of thing, right? But actually, how much is in this ComCare fund? Do people actually know this, right? It's not advertised very much. But as of 2021, I believe, there was 2.4 billion Singapore dollars inside. It's an endowment fund. It keeps growing and growing and growing. And I think we just added more money after this budget. But actually, how much is actually going to low-income families? It's just 177 million. That's just less than 10%. Each year, it's about this amount. COVID was an exceptional year. You had maybe 12, 13% of the fund. Yet, families are saying, low-income families are saying that they don't have enough, right? Actually, if we talk about using the ComCare fund more to actually, I think you're capable of totally eradicating poverty, that puts the middle income, that puts the even the rich actually, right? They don't need to really do anything here. The fund can just be used for that, right? But we're not talking about it. So whenever, you know, even when opposition parties, right, when they come and say that, oh yeah, we want to introduce wealth taxes, the debate always brings up, oh, how much is it going to cost my residents, right? The more upper class residents to pay for your residents. Actually, not that much, right? These endowment funds are more than enough to actually pay for these basic needs. But we're not talking enough about that, I feel. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I guess so. Just before we end, I wanted to, you know, go back to the whole idea of Manifestival, because essentially it's like, you know, a coalition of civil society groups all coming together in solidarity and to organize events like these. But, you know, for a lot of coalitions in the past, they've been short-lived, they spring up and then they fade away. So I guess from your perspective, how do you think, you know, these sort of coalitions can sustain their presence in Singapore? Is the environment conducive to doing so?
Yes, so I think it is not necessarily a sign of failure when coalitions come to an end. It really depends on what the intention or driving force for coming together was, right? So in the past, one of the things that many civil society groups have come together to do is the UPR report, for example, the Universal Periodic Review. So when the report's done, then, you know, they stop working together, right? So, I mean, and that's fine. So it really depends on, I think, having clarity in your vision. What are you coming together for? What are you coming together around? And I think we sustain when we nourish each other, right? When coming together feeds all of us and strengthens all of our movements and builds one united sort of movement and where we can continue to learn from each other, benefit from our shared analysis resources, and also to tap on each other where we can to move things forward, right? So I think it is also comes down to often the strength of relationships, right? How much time people are spending with each other, working together. So I think, for example, doing the town halls together has been an incredible bonding opportunity for the organizers, right? Who've come from different civil society organizations. So in working together, we learn to care for each other. And so I think it is also about having a particular momentum and rhythm and understanding that people need rest and people also need enough to keep going, right? Because if there's too much, say, lag between opportunities to come together, momentum can die out. But if there's too much, then people can feel overstretched. So it's really, I think, being attentive to each other. And the other thing that's really important in keeping such spaces alive is that everyone feels they have a voice and can contribute and they feel valued in the space and that they're both able to give and take from it. So I think if all of those things are in place, definitely, you know, we'll be able to sustain and also see that there is a lot of value in that solidarity, right? Especially in an environment like, you know, you asked the question, is it conducive in Singapore to doing so? I would say, to me, it's more that it is necessary to do so in an environment like Singapore, where the government is very quick to pit groups against each other, to play good activist, bad activist, and to, you know, really, you know, the way that we stratify the working class also stratifies civil society. So I think it is necessary to stand with each other if we are to make any progress towards the changes that we want to see.
So what's next for Manifestival and your various organizations after the town halls?
Labor Day! Yes, so Workers Made Possible, but actually not just Workers Made Possible, but again, like a coalition of a lot of different groups. We are organizing Labor Day rally. And really, like, I think we shouldn't really think about it as like these groups are organizing Labor Day, but Labor Day is happening. We are all going to Labor Day. And yeah, you know, like we are all building it. And I think, yeah, it can be so many groups, you know, coming, setting up booths and everything. But if the audience, the participants don't come and people, just workers don't come, right? Then it's also not Labor Day. So everybody's building Labor Day together. Every person who comes is equally important. But yeah, we'll be having like speeches, we'll be having performances. And I think most importantly, we'll be coalescing around a set of 15 demands. And the demands that we have come together around is they're all based on the exact same things that we've been talking about in the town halls, in our conversations with workers from all sorts of different groups. Yeah, from like the on the ground work that we've been doing in our various organizations.
From rental flat tenants.
From rental flat tenants all the way to, you know, people living in condos maybe.
Yeah.
I think the work of like trying to point out that the commonalities between us and the need for us to like stand together and to rally around a vision of Singapore that's like a better and fairer country, right, for all of us. That's what like Labor Day is all about. Yeah,
and we're calling it the People's 15 Demands because it was a very participatory process that led to the emergence of the demands. So they're not like Workers Make Possible demands, right? Mm-hmm. And so what we're calling on people to do is come to Labor Day if you identify with these demands, if these are demands that will improve your lives or the lives of your neighbors or other people you care about, right? Like whether it's migrant workers or anyone else in our communities. And yeah, so Manifestival, I mean, this is not really a Manifestival event, but it is, but Labor Day is something that all the organizations are putting a lot of time and energy towards. But after that, I think we all need a break. So I'll make a break from Manifestival for about a month or two, and then we'll be back with other events in the second half of the year.
I don't have much to add, but yeah, I mean, just to give us a bit of a sneak peek to like some of the demands, in case, you know, some of the viewers, they don't follow us on Instagram. Follow us on Instagram, by the way. Yeah, or TikTok or Facebook, we're not that active, but TikTok and Instagram are very active. But yeah, like things like stopping further GST hikes, introducing, you know, wealth tax for the ultra wealthy, bringing back rent control. We did say that, right? Bringing back rent control. Yes, correct. Unemployment insurance as well.
The right to rest is a big one that cuts across many sectors.
Yeah, and like extending
overtime pay, right, for your middle-income professionals and minimum wages. So we also don't just talk about minimum wages in the full-time worker sense. We also talk about for food delivery riders, they go by fares. So we talk about a minimum fare guarantee, and the riders, the right group of riders that we know, they really believe in the demand for a $6 minimum fare guarantee. So come down to Labor Day, where these workers will be talking about their demands. They'll be sharing, you know, what went into it. They'll also be sharing their struggles. They'll be sharing their aspirations. And not just that, you'll also be hearing from performers, right? There'll be a lot of performances, and the booths will be very exciting. And yeah, first 100 people who come get a yummy work like a dog cheese dog, right? Made by one of the tenants. Yeah. So yeah, it's a 1st May, 3 to 7 p.m. At Hong Lim Park.
Oh, yep. Thanks for the preview. And yep, for listeners, you've heard them. 1st May, 3 to 7 p.m. Hong Lim Park. Be there or be square. So once again, thanks Koki, Adi and Kuma from Manny Festival. Thanks so much for coming on to the podcast.
Thank you, Isaac.
Thank you.